You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist, and this of course is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is going out on October 13th, 2024, 5 days from my 53rd birthday. And that being said, I want to thank my donors as always, and my friends who keep me independent and who have done so all these years. I was on program a few hours ago with Peter Quijones. I don't know if you've come across him before. I'm on his show, I don't know, every few months. And he wanted to talk to, actually, it was a listener who said, I want to talk about the Cossacks and the Jews, especially within the Polish Empire, and Matthew Johnson is the only one who I would trust to do it, from the proper point of view, not from the establishment point of view. And that's what we talked about. And so I want to add more detail to that. As you know, I published a book, Ukrainian Nationalism. I think that was just before the lockdown, where I deal with some of this. But over the years, I'm always adding to it because these are very complicated topics and they couldn't be more relevant today. Keep in mind that the present government in Kiev has no legitimacy, is Jewish, and hence the opposite of everything that the Cossack host, wherever they were found, stands for. And their persecution of the church is very, very much indicative of that. My point of view is that the Cossack forces were anti-colonialist freedom fighters. Their targets were, among other places, or other people, the Judeo-Polish oppression of the oligarchs who ruled Poland until Poland fell apart in the late 18th century. This is what created a Russo-Ukrainian identity and brought down the, at one point, very large Polish Empire. There was a time where 85% of the world's Jews lived within the Polish Empire. And because of their positions of power and prestige, it was called the Paradise of the Jews. But that quickly became an orgy of destruction. The Cossacks and the Orthodox peasants had enough of their oppression. Now, of course, Jews will never take responsibility for their hatred and oppression of the Orthodox peasantry, reaching its apogee in the 17th century. But the Jews are entirely responsible for the uprising of Bogdan Khmelnytsky in 1648 and later uprisings. Well, the paper I'm working on in this regard, which uses some information from my Ukraine book, is Beyond Khmelnytsky, Cossack Rebellions, the Jews, and the End of the Polish Commonwealth. So, starting at the beginning, by the end of the 15th century, there were certain Cossack communities calling themselves that were in Central Europe near the major trade routes at the time. The Dnieper, the Vistula, and the rest. And they were joined by significant numbers of settlers from Moscow, Russian Lithuania, and points north. The Russian and Bell's voivodeships of Poland, and many other places. So by the result is by the 16th century, these groups had grown into large free, in other words, they had no lord, military formations, and they were simultaneously autonomous, well-organized communities, and they took their names from where they were, the Zaporozhians, the Don Cossacks, Volga, etc. The word Cossack is, at least the majority theory, is a Turkic word that means freebooter. Every once in a while, you'll see it in a name. Now, I've made the claim that the so-called Mongols, who were not Asiatic, who ruled Russia in the Middle Ages, were connected to this development. Because before they were called Cossacks, they were called Circassians. And they roamed in the southern steppe outskirts of the Polish-Lithuanian kingdom. And we have records of this starting in the 15th century. They certainly existed prior to that, but the records are more spotty. Initially, they lived in the southern Kiev region, eastern Podolia, and began to be called again by where they were located, Dnieper, Zaporozhian. And then you have issues like the Zaporozhian Sikh, registered Cossacks, court Cossacks, etc. The localized famine, 1601-1603, landowners, although who were legally charged to feed their serfs, simply couldn't do it. And they had no choice but to leave. So fleeing from this hunger, the serfs, largely abandoned, moved to the free outskirts of Russia, which we call Ukraine. Ukraine meaning borderland, frontier. But these servants, many of whom had weapons and combat experience, formed communities. I don't want to call them gangs. Some of them went bad, but overwhelmingly, they played a significant role in the formation of the Free Cossacks of the Don, the Volga, what have you. Now, Tsarist diplomats in this period said several times that these Cossacks were, for the most part, runaway serfs. And they always tried to claim that they were robber gangs and whatever before they developed their own sense of mission. Isaac Massa wrote that, quote, for the most part, servants who had run away from their masters joined the Cossacks. Although, as we see, initially it wasn't really voluntary. The chronograph of the early 17th century calls the Cossacks runaway serfs and rabid thieves. There's a chronicle, the tale of the Azov siege in the 17th century, and they talk about the Cossacks as being former serfs. And they're quoted as saying, we are fleeing from that Moscow state, from eternal labor, involuntary servitude, from the boyars and the nobles of the sovereign. So, however you slice it, they came into existence representing a non-statist, free, communal, and very Orthodox, very Russian Orthodox people. During the time of troubles in Russia, the Cossacks played a huge role, and in fact, it was an anti-Russian role. It was the rebel forces. Early on in the time of troubles, the Cossacks of the military borderlands, South Russia, were very distinguished, and in fact, for the most part, these uprisings, the only competent combat troops were Cossacks. And then later on, the Cossacks had a serious influence on the course of this liberation movement. The time of troubles saw the Polish-Lithuanian occupation of Moscow from 1611 to 1612. The Cossacks helped liberate it. In fact, they put Moscow under siege, and they made a huge contribution to the liberation of all Russia at that point. The decline, though, was to be found in the 18th centuries. The Russian authorities, both pre- and post-Petrin, conflicted with their freebooting way of life. And whether it be against Poland or against Russia, the ones against Russia were Bolotnikov, Balash, Razin, Bulavin, and Pugachev. In each case, especially the latter ones, they were old believers. They were strictly Orthodox and strictly communal. They had rejected any sense of serfdom. Cossacks saw themselves as knights, as members of their own nobility, and they will fight anyone who refuses to treat them accordingly. After the Bulavin Rebellion, the Cossack host, the community on the Don, which is just in Russia, was officially deprived of independence. The Dnieper goes through Ukraine, separating it right bank and left bank. The Don is just over the border. and sometimes comes very close, in one spot comes very close to the Volga. And we see this pattern happening over and over again. One of the most powerful units was the Zaporozhian Sikh Cossacks, who were constantly at war with central governments, or governments in general, whether Turkish, Polish, or Russian. They were the ones who developed the lands of New Russia. They sacked the estates of the secular gentry in Little Russia, places like Novosibirsk and the lands of and the lands points east. Eventually, it was Catherine II destroyed the Sikh and the Zaporozhian force. When Pugachev revolted against Russian landlords, his manifestos concerned the restoration of all rights and liberties of the Zaporozhian Cossacks and freedom from the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And that's where Catherine had ordered the liquidation of the Zaporozhian host in the Sikh. Zaporozhia, which comes up in the Ukraine war quite a bit, means beyond the rapids. Their fortress was on a series of islands in some of the most inhospitable parts of that river. We're talking about the Dnieper. They were headed by a hetman, H-E-T-M-A-N, who was elected, whether it be elected by the community or just by warriors, depended on what period of time we're talking about. But in 1775, the Pugachev rebellion against Catherine was put down, and Cossack autonomy was history. Zaporozhye was disbanded, the Volga Cossack host was disbanded, and by 1788, the Zaporozhians were restored under the name of the host of the faithful Zaporozhian. And then the Black Sea Cossack host resettled in Kuban. And the Kuban Cossack host still exists today. There was no state that can tolerate Cossack forces for long, because their primary concern was their own freedom and autonomy, their rejection of your typical state structure, and certainly an empire. And in saving Orthodox people, whether it be slaves or peasants, from Jewish control. And this is how they saw themselves. And that was, you know, from then on in, you had, I guess, what you could call de-Cossackization. And probably the worst thing you can do to a Cossack is to render them a serf. And this happened. This happened in Poland sometimes, and it happened during the reign of Catherine II. The Cossacks also played a substantial role in the defeat of Napoleon during the War of 1812. So sometimes the Russian authorities needed them. And in this case, Cossack militias were being revitalized and reorganized. And the main army was regularly relieved by Cossack forces who served as partisans. Now, this was a religious group of men. They were Orthodox, usually old believers after 1667. Their opponents, the Jews, Muslims from Turkey, although not necessarily the Muslim from Crimea, Roman Catholic Church of Poland, and in particular, the Uniates. Many of you know, I was a Uniate many years ago. A Uniate is a Catholic who uses the Slavo-Byzantine Rite. And by the middle of the 19th century, though, the single householders formed the backbone of the emerging Cossack. But long before then, the fight against the Uniates, which was a very sneaky way of bringing Orthodox under Catholic control, that is to say, under Polish control, was seen as particularly obnoxious. And the Uniate bishops, after 1595, when they were established, were engaged in the repression of Orthodox peasants, and they paid the price when the Cossacks showed up. By the first half of the 19th century, much later, Cossacks had become a separate class, almost a caste. They were border guards and even borders among different peoples. They even were a part of the emperor's personal escort all the way up to Tsar Nicholas II. So the 19th century saw some modicum of autonomy and were largely exempt from taxes. Of course, they paid in blood. But as the 20th century dawned, the only full military service class in Russia were the Cossacks. Their numbers were about 3%, roughly, of the total population of the Russian Empire. And many scholars and writers have Cossack roots. It is not its own ethnicity. They're either Ukrainian or Russian. But technically, so long as they spoke one Slavic language, they could be anything so long as they were Orthodox. But it's possible to call them a sub-ethnic community. And they were distinguished, you know, dress and everything else, from the rest of the Russian population. World War I, really, August, September 1917, the Cossacks were again reorganized. They wanted to consolidate units of Cossack troops on the fronts into their own Cossack armies. But, of course, the Revolutionary Era, the Cossacks were a big part of the Civil War. They, and I've lectured on this many times in the past, they stood in the middle. They were certainly a part of the white forces, but their goals were more specific, and that was their big error. They wanted their own local autonomy and weren't all that worried about, you know, a free Russia. Most Cossacks fought against the Soviet government along with the White Army, especially in their, you know, areas of the, you know, the Don and even the Volga. A handful tried to remain neutral. But Cossack communities were revitalized in this era, since at the time there was no real power over them, and they kind of carved out their own broad autonomy. The Don Army, the Kuban Republic, etc. But the Cossacks were the most competent combatants of the White Army in the southern, southwestern theater. And of course, they became a part of the white immigration. There was a handful that did support the Bolsheviks. They clearly were lied to. Their atheism was hidden from them. But whether or not, you know, anyone can call himself a Cossack, any a group of people outside of state control living in that part of the world can call themselves that. And of course, the Cossacks were tormented by the Soviet government. Today, the Cossacks, over the last 20 years, have been revitalized and support the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia, but they certainly have their old believer roots. So religiously, it's one or the other. You notice they're not brought up in the Russo-Ukrainian War. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get into that now. But one of the dominant themes in Cossack life was the Jewish question. The situation in the Polish Empire was very tense. The Polish Empire was an oligarchy. The only people who mattered were wealthy landowners. They had no power over them. And they had, years earlier, brought the Jews in to take care of financial matters in the cities, to lend them money, to be their advisors. So any force supporting the crown, who they hated, in Poland could not arise and finance the monarchy, as was the case in Great Britain. Therefore, over time, the tense situation, the slacha, as they call it, the handful of elite Polish families that controlled everything, had this army of intermediaries between the landowners and their subjects. This kind of serfdom had more in common with slavery than anything else. And Jews were extremely important, allowing the Polish noble to do what he wanted. And they became dissolute in many ways. The Jews were granted pretty much anything where an income can be had. Taverns, especially taverns, and which includes the distilling of alcohol, internal trade duties, mills, of course, very important in agrarian society, fishing rights in those areas. They charge tolls over bridges. They use peasant labor to build dams and whatever else they needed. And the most obnoxious part was their control of entire villages, including the Orthodox churches within them. So Polish landlords sometimes rented out their entire estates with all of these income-generating items. And the Jews, wanting to squeeze out as much as possible, sort of half aware that this can't last forever, were very inventive and very creative in their exploitation. And the slightest disobedience, the entire administrative and police apparatus of the Polish government was at their service. But that usually meant either a noble family and his militia, or what they call a confederation, or a union, temporary union of powerful Polish noble families. So the average peasant in the Polish Empire had no direct contact with their landlord. The Commonwealth dealt with Jewish intermediaries. And so the anger that was generated, the indignation, the resentment against all of these high taxes, heavy levies, labor dues, fell upon the Jews because they did what they wanted. They had to serve their masters, quote-unquote, the landlords, who were masters of nothing, but they were granted their legitimacy, such as it was, by Polish landlord class. There's a cycle, almost a poetic cycle called the Dumy, the plural of Duma. The word means thinking or thought. It's used a little bit differently in Ukrainian than in Russian. But these poetic cycles talking about Jewish oppression, and I first came across them when I read the Ukrainian historian Gadaszewski, who was a socialist and a socialist revolutionary. Therefore, he wasn't, you know, inherently anti-Jewish. But he talks about how popular any anti-Jewish concept was among the peasants, and certainly among the Cossacks in that era. Any market had to pay a cut to the Kahal. The Kahal is the autonomous community of Jews. Even travelers either had their property stolen or had to pay tolls. There's a sort of a chronicle called the Duma on the Enslavement of the Cossacks by the Jews. And it says a whole lot of things about this. The Jew was the person, the Jew almost took the place of the clergy. If you needed money, very much like a mafia loan shark, and you paid a vig, and you'd be paying them forever. No one can get ahead. Money begets money. Usury begets more usury. The typical Polish landlord didn't even know how in debt he really was. You have so many first-hand accounts of someone who owes the Jews money. They march into a tavern, grab the guy by the hair, and screaming and yelling at him for putting the needs of his wife and children ahead of what they owe. But there's no question, though there have been some rumbling that this wasn't true, but the Jews, again, in the name of the landlord who they worked for, owned churches. And people, you know, the great historian Kostomarov, who comes up, had a whole chapter in my book on him. And so that was the most obnoxious aspect of this Jewish control. And the Polish landlords were, I don't want to use the word obsessed, but they cared about keeping the crown at bay. They will deliberately lose wars so that the crown can't take, you know, the king of Poland, the emperor of the Polish Empire, can't take credit for. Now, as far as Cossack uprisings are concerned, Most of the primary sources say that it was the obnoxious behavior of the Jews that caused it. There was a Colonel Krivonos, Prince Zaslavsky, the Moscow merchant Kunikov, who was traveling through Ukraine the winter of 1648-1649, the Roman Catholic canon Yusufovich. All of these talk about, in detail, the hateful behavior of the Jewish intermediaries and the nature of their kahal system. Kunikov says, the Jews robbed and abused the Ukrainians. And as soon as they distilled vodka or brewed beer without telling a Jew and didn't take off his hat in front of a Jew, the Jews would attack him, rob him, and destroy him. Took away his property and forcibly took his wives and children as slaves. The Roman Catholic canon, as I mentioned, from Lvov, not Uniate, Roman Catholic, who said that the domination of the Poles reached such an unbearable oppression that they even gave power over the churches to the Jewish race. The Cossack priest could not in his church perform the sacraments of baptism, marriage, or anything else if he did not pay the Jew in advance for the keys, and the fee set by the master, had to take them from the church doors each time and give them to the Jew. And his last line, in what I quoted from him, "You have suffered your troubles as you deserve, Poles." In other words, this is a fault. I mean, the Jews did the work, but it's the fault of the Polish nobility that brought them in a few centuries prior to this and allowed them to run rampant. And in fact, the Jews functioned the way that they did, knowing that the landlords would take action on their behalf. Even Khmelnytsky himself, the great Cossack hetman, who led the greatest of the uprisings against the Judeo-Polish oppression, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, in his surviving letters, he talks about not just the financial degradation of the population, but the moral degradation. Because in that early era, they were involved in white slavery, so-called erotica, prostitution, and anything to destroy the moral fabric of both Polish and Ukrainian society. Khmelnytsky's surviving letters talk about the injustices that the peasant class had to endure from the Jews. The heavy dues, the heavy taxes. Because all of these income opportunities were farmed out to the Jews. Now, there was a rabbi from Volin, Nathan Hanover. I'm not sure if he's a rabbi or not, but he was a Jewish writer. In his memoirs, and he was, you know, alive at the time, talks about the corvée work, that is to say, the labor dues for the magnates, but, you know, with the Jews as the intermediary, burdened with heavy work in the house and in the field. The elite imposed heavy taxes on them, and they were forced to convert to either the Unia or Roman Catholicism. And this Jew says the Russian people were so humiliated that all nations, even the most humiliated of all nations, the Jews, also ruled over them. Now, the Jews were in absolutely no humiliating position at the time. They were living in their paradise. And eventually, the concept grew up that this is the era of the Messiah. There's no other way to explain how these tremendous privileges and wealth so quickly came to them if this wasn't this era. This was another reason why they never reined in their arrogance and their greed. They knew that if they kept going, there would be a revolt and a bloody one. But because so many were convinced that this was the age of the Messiah, he's coming any day now, so we can do whatever we want in the meantime. And it wasn't just them, of course. The Jesuits were a huge part of forcible conversions, you know, using the Jews as they saw fit. No one forced the Jews to do this. They were in their element. I'll go so far as to say our modern Ashkenazi Jew takes so much of his identity, Talmudic identity, from this era, 17th century Poland. Nothing has changed in terms of their behavior. A long time ago, I wrote a lengthy paper on the emperor's commissions headed by Gawrile Dzierżawy. Once Poland fell apart, the emperor, both Paul and Alexander, realized that they had now brought in some of these very lands into the Russian Empire once Poland fell apart. They weren't all that up on Jewish nature at the time. So Dzierżawy was sent to collect information on why everyone hates the Jews out there, because it did create instability. And when his collection was called The Opinion, with a capital O. And he arrived in Belarus the summer of 1800 and immediately was struck by the condition of the peasantry. They were clearly hungry. They were malnourished. Yet their barns were packed with grain. First thing he did, he was barely off the coach. And in the name of the emperor, ordered the distribution of this from the possession of the Polish prince, John Ognitski. Because the elite landowners were still there, despite the Polish Empire being non-existent. And that he had taken the names of the landlords who were deliberately starving the peasants. Later on, he realized who was the engine behind that. And that was powerful Jewish merchants and the Kahal system. And eventually wrote back to the emperor that there's good reason why the peasantry hates the Jews out here. One abuse he discovered was that both Poles and Jews, but I shouldn't say Poles, the short-term leases, and the short-term, like think something like today, a month-to-month, so they could raise their rent anytime they want. This was a Jewish thing. Dzierżawy demanded that leases be at least 9 years. All the stipulations of those kind of contracts were not enforced. He demanded that they become enforced. He also noted the Jewish vodka monopoly. And Dzierżawy was not anti-Jewish. If anything, he was Philo-Semitic when he was sent over there, but that didn't last long. Here's what Dzierżawy states, and I actually got this from Solzhenitsyn, but it's straight out of his opinion. Many different opinions on the Jews have been given since I've been here. I find that the Kahal to be a nest of hatred and subversion of Christianity. These organizations are effective and well-funded. In Prussia, they've been destroyed. They serve no one but themselves. Making their money from liquor is based on it being used as a lure, and few can refuse. The legal device of Hazaka is a way to keep in their hands control over the peasant land in perpetuity. Hedmi is a cover for atrocity to the detriment of all local commerce. And finally, the Kolidov, an impervious, profane concealment of the most horrifying barbarities to the detriment of public and private life. It is a method of proficient thievery. Now, let me interpret that for you. The Zaki and Hermi, these were ways of taking the legitimate property of others. A Zaki is a taking of symbolic land ownership, and it was a Talmudic means of getting around any law against it. The latter is a means of voiding all contracts made with the peasantry or any non-Jew, actually. These were all essentially slip-and-fall tricks, scams, that neither the peasants nor the Polish landlords understood. The entire economy was in Jewish hands. Kolidov was insidious. It was the practice of getting peasants drunk at harvest time, when they had money, of course, so as to entice them to take out larger loans at usurious rates. Initially, they came in and they undercut everybody, and once their competition was gone, they raised their rates. This was not the news that Dzierżawy wanted to bring back to the capital. The Jews functioned as the middlemen of the Polish economy, which means to solve the peasant problem was to either expropriate them or assimilate them. Emperor Paul wanted to settle them on the land as small proprietors, but this was very naive. Of course, all Jews refused any of that because the life of the peasant was not nearly as profitable as their unproductive parasitism. They made their money out of gouging peasants because they were seen as mere cattle to be manipulated. Now, I mention this because, although this was the case in 1800, nothing had changed from the period of time prior to that, where the Polish Empire, many centuries earlier, brought the Jews in and reached their apogee in the 17th century. Nothing had changed. It's the same kind of thing. The Polish nobility, though theologically illiterate, were very Roman Catholic. It's made exploiting peasants much easier since the farmer was religiously, ethnically, and culturally alien to him. This was the Jewish control of Orthodox parishes, and the few Orthodox parishes remaining in eastern and southern Poland were padlocked for services until a substantial fee was paid to the Jewish leaseholder. This was particularly obnoxious. And with all of this, the starving peasant, with having cultivated a huge amount of grain, which of course didn't benefit them, the intensity of this kind of serfdom was driven by the late Renaissance era spike in Western populations, the growth of the money economy, and this urban development in the West brought grain demand very high, and the price went up. That means the Jews took a larger cut, and the peasant was worked nearly to death. And given the realities of Polish economics, it meant that Slavic grain was exported by a Jewish network headquartered in a few places: Antwerp, Constantinople, Krakow, and London. It has satellite branches in Spain, Amsterdam, and eventually St. Petersburg. This is the network that permitted Jewish bankers to secure interest rates when they had competition far lower than anyone else. Such rates were irresistible, and if guaranteed by Jewish elites in the network, would place those close to the Jews at a distinct advantage against their rivals. There were poorer Jews. Derzhavin talks about them. He says the simple, poorer Jews are blinded and dazzled by other Jews so that an imperishable partition is created. They are surrounded by superstition, such that they remain a unified society. Children learn from the Talmud, which protects the position of the wealthy. The Talmud gives us no hope in their eventual change of manners. Well, eventually, this exploded. And in 1648, the Cossacks had had enough, and Bogdan Khmelnytsky destroyed the Polish elite and their Jewish hangers-on throughout the Slavic, the Ukrainian part of the empire, killing many civilians. The confederations had militia. I wouldn't call them regular forces. But the peasantry had had enough. And one of the things they had enough of was the mentality of the Talmud, mystifying the power of the rabbis and justifying Jewish rule, that the Goyim were savage beasts, and it kept all Jews, no matter what their income, huddled together in fear. So even the Jews who didn't like this sort of thing were so terrified at the stories they heard about the Goyim that they stayed loyal. So the Kahal essentially victimized everyone around it. So what was the goal of the Khmelnytsky rebellion? The goal essentially was to export the Cossack form of social organization to the peasantry of the Polish Empire, especially the Orthodox peasantry. The liberation of the nation and what came after that was important. Now, there are several options here. Some writers hold that what Khmelnytsky wanted was a creation of a completely independent state. Another theory is that Khmelnytsky wanted to create an autonomous unit within the borders of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, kind of like Lithuania had done earlier. And finally, the third theory is that the ultimate goal was the creation of an autonomous federal unit within the Russian state. Now, the great Ukrainian historian Gudoshevsky accepts the first option, the creation of an independent state. Most writers now say that this doesn't stand up to any criticism. We have the handwritten letters of Khmelnytsky in the Moscow archives, and even in the first months of his uprising, the tremendous, crushing victories over the Poles, Khmelnytsky asked Moscow not just for help, but also for consent to the gradual reunification of Ukraine with Moscow. The creation of a Russian principality, Cossack principality, within the Polish Empire, that had its supporters, but that tended to be the landed, the wealthy of the Cossack forces. I mean, the unlimited freedom of the Polish gentry attracted a lot of attention. The registered Cossacks, who actually were a noble class. If you were on the registry held by the Poles, you didn't have to pay taxes and you could never be placed in a condition of serfdom. So the concept of the registry, how many names are on it, became a huge battleground. Many already wealthy Cossacks wanted to be like the Polish elite. And I think that's a little hard. That's the Russian point of view. I think that's way too hard. We're talking about a man named Vyhovsky and the proposed, although never implemented, Treaty of Hajdacz in 1658 to create the Commonwealth would be not just Poland-Lithuania, but Poland-Lithuania-Rus within that Commonwealth. But the drive to become a part of Moscow while maintaining broad autonomy, which was partly realized as a result of the uprising, it seems to be inevitable. It seems to make sense, given the foreign policy situation and the mood of the population at large. The Cossack host, as elite and as combat capable as they were surrounded with enemies. They had neighbors like the Polish Empire, who eventually were going to take tremendous revenge on this, not to mention the Turks, who were at the time the height of their power. And Poland was at the time one of the strongest states in Europe, one of the largest states in Europe. The Ukrainian Cossacks had zero chance of withstanding a conflict with any of these entities. The Khmelnytsky uprising was localized to the Orthodox areas. So even if Khmelnytsky wanted to create a separate state, it couldn't last long. And being the leader of the many Cossack rebellions that occurred over the centuries, it really was a balancing act. The Russians ended up violating most of the autonomy that they promised to the Cossacks. And so there was a tendency then to look at the Poles, and the great Hetman Doroshenko looked to Turkey. But Khmelnytsky was aware that the popular option was towards Moscow. And that's really where he went. Of course, we all know that Mazepa went to Sweden, the only one to do that. But Khmelnytsky's uprising started because both the Cossacks and the peasants, their patience was absolutely exhausted. I can't do it justice in explaining it the way I am right now. One of the things that Khmelnytsky did was he sent an embassy to the Crimean Khan for assistance. Crimea was very upset with the Poles. The Polish government had to pay a tribute every year that bought them off so they wouldn't raid Polish territory. The Poles stopped paying that. In the Tartar lands, in the Crimean area, you had crop failure and you had disease that affected the cattle. They wanted to make up for this by plundering Poland. So the Khan, and these were Muslims, of course, the Khan agreed to help Khmelnytsky and sent 4,000 men. He needed Tartar help. He accepted it, but he also knew that nothing good was going to come out of it. In the initial stages of combat, yes, they were necessary, but he knew they were going to plunder and commit violence during the campaign. These were aliens to these Muslims. Khmelnytsky was forced to send his son, one of his sons, Timofey, to the Khan as a hostage. Because without that, the Khan at the time was Islam Giray III, did not want to send his army otherwise. He also thought that maybe the presence of the Khan's army with Khmelnytsky guaranteed him against the possibility of Tartars being bribed by Poland and hence attacked from the rear. But by April 1648, Khmelnytsky had 10,000 troops at his disposal, including those from the Crimea, And that was the initial combat force that attacked Poland. Once they realized that Khmelnytsky was organizing, they knew what was coming, and they offered him the moon. And of course, he knew that that was just negotiations were a way to marshal their forces. The attack on the Polish Empire from Cossack territory, it alarmed the Polish elite, to say the very least. In fact, it sent them into a panic. So they just wanted to pretend to have negotiations with him, promising him whatever they could come up with. But all of Orthodox Ukraine was ready to fight. There was a Polish military leader and landlord, Pataki. He wrote the Polish monarch saying, "This destructive flame has flared up so much that there was no village, no town, where calls for this self-will were not heard, and where attempts on the lives and property of their lords and owners were not being prepared." In other words, 100% of the Ukrainian, that is to say, the border of not just Russia and Ukraine, but Poland and Ukraine, the Slavic Orthodox and Cossack regions, 100% was behind Khmelnytsky. The largest magnate in the left bank, that is to say, the eastern side of the Dnieper, name was Vyshinevsky. And he was by far the wealthiest of this elite. Vyshinevsky, I'm sorry, is how you properly pronounce it. It was him and Pataki that led the Polish response. And they were defeated early on. Zwotywory and Korsun, even his headquarters, was captured by the rebels who slaughtered the Jesuits and Jews there that didn't manage to leave in time with Vyshinevsky. There are primary documents that exist about Vyshinevsky's retreat from the left bank. He was cut off from Poland by the Dnieper River. He was trapped. He led the evacuation of the entire left bank. So there was this coalition under his and Pataki's control. The elite, mercenaries, of course, the Jews, Roman Catholics, and Uniates. They knew what would happen if they fell into the hands of the rebels. Hanover, the rabbi who I mentioned earlier, who was a contemporary with these events, talks about this, what he calls the exodus of Jews from the left bank, together with the Poles. And he makes it clear that, of course, the Poles, the landlords, treated the Jews very well and protected them and defended them in every possible way against the Cossacks. Now, Hanover was aware, at least in part, as to why this rebellion occurred. And the behavior of some rebels, you talk about all of this pent-up hatred to have your human dignity stripped every single day, called goyim, having some vague idea of what that means. They just went bonkers. And the same thing with, you know, they did it to the Jesuits, to the Uniates. The Cossacks were a bit more restrained, but the peasants were far more dangerous. Now, all the Jews want to talk about, again, they'll never take responsibility for this. This is entirely on them. What did they expect? E. Michael Jones has that great line, "Instead of the Messiah as they had promised themselves, they got Khmelnytsky instead." And this was before Khmelnytsky could direct this uprising towards any long-term solution. A long-term solution, which, by the way, never really came. I think, really, Kiev was the last place that Polish power was preserved. So you had plenty of people who took refuge there And of course, the Polish response, once they gained the upper hand again, was extremely, extremely violent. But after Khmelnytsky, nothing was ever the same again. The Jews never talked about it. Now, later on, the Jews went back to their old ways. You see it even in the, from 1800 on with Dyrshavin, but even before that, the last great uprising, the Haidamak uprising, which I've spoken of many times before, again, they were in the same conditions under Polish control and areas under Polish control as they had been at this point. Now, the Cossack host sees itself as a knightly army, regular and full-time. And as I said before, their purpose was to protect the Orthodox Church, that above everything, to rescue Orthodox slaves, and then later on, to fight for their own autonomy against whoever was assisting them at the time. And they're all very tightly interwoven. And the Jews were central to all of this. Now, we're talking about an almost regular state of revolt from the 16th to the 18th century. You had so many different power centers. The Sikh itself, the Russian Empire, the Polish elite, Turkey, Crimea, occasionally Sweden, the Cossacks themselves and their various factions, all, you know, had to be balanced because the Hetmanate had to be in some sort of alliance with a combination of these powers, depending on circumstances. Now, the Hetman state was founded after the rebellion of Khmelnytsky. The Zaporozhye was quite a distance away, but it differed ideologically and in terms of policy from the Hetman state in Ukraine proper. Now, in the past, Moscow and Poland tried to buy off the wealthier Cossack officers through grants of land and guarantees of political power. In other words, certain landowners were convinced to accept the rule of a foreign power if they granted them land, serfs, and they were willing to protect it militarily. In this drive to have Cossack recognized as a noble title, they were given other noble titles that at least were recognized internationally. And both Poles and Russians engaged in this, the strategic use of land ownership. The British did the same thing in Ireland. This will eventually tear the host apart. This will destroy the Cossacks almost. It destroyed the possibility of any independent state or any autonomy. Elites turned out to have more in common than the elites had, no matter where they were from, with their own people. Khmelnytsky and so many of these patriotic Cossacks were not like that. Freedom and equality within the military apparatus, that was the hallmark of the Cossack host. You know, smaller fortresses eventually were merged into the Sikh complex. But the agenda by the 1620s was very clear. And the religious issue was of central importance. The Uniates, the Orthodox Slavs, who under the Pope of Rome used the Slavo-Byzantine Rite, coming out of the Union of Brest in 1595, usually those parishes had no idea they were in communion with the Pope of Rome. They'd mentioned the Pope's name one time at the canon. And it was a bit of a trick. It was a forcible unification of the Ukrainian Orthodox with Polish Catholics, and it was wrong on many levels. The Polish Church, this is not about Roman Catholicism as such, but in Poland, it was an oligarchic institution. It never failed to promote its interests. It was forced on people by the Polish army, although not without certain controversies from the Vatican. The oligarchs wanted a forced conversion to the Latin Rite, but the Vatican liked the idea of a gradual conversion via the Uniate Church, the so-called Eastern Rite Catholics. This was never meant to be an actual functional church. The very concept is a contradiction. That's why I had to leave it many years ago, 25 years ago. It's a contradiction because the theology of the Eastern liturgy is rejected by the Roman Church as it had been revivified at Trent. So the so-called Greek Catholics, which actually is a term for orthodoxy, that was just a political expedient. It was a way to bring them gradually into the Latin Rite. So the modern Greek Catholic Church, meaning the Uniates, is a historical and theological absurdity. It's a relic of Polish oligarchic violence. And that's right out of my Ukraine book. Unions were your typical outgrowth of the Vatican ideology as practiced in Poland. Force, violence, and fraud. The union was largely fraudulent because people didn't know that they were within this body. All of this was perfectly acceptable. And then, of course, the Church of Rome in Poland, using the Latin Rite from the Council of Trent, that did penetrate the Byzantine Rite. The synthesis of the two, even amongst the Ukrainian Orthodox, was actually pretty interesting. Beyond that, the third player was the Orthodox Church of Russia, and then the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which traces itself to Theophanes of Jerusalem. And even them, they had their westernization, which in and of itself was okay. Because the Orthodox Church of Ukraine was within a Jesuit-controlled milieu, Catholic imperialism from Poland, many of the Orthodox reformers had been educated in Jesuit and scholastic academies. And there's nothing absolutely wrong with that. And stuff like that didn't penetrate into Russia until the later 18th century. Many of the Russian Orthodox see Ukrainians as semi-Latinized. And the Patriarch of Constantinople may be a possible fifth player. It was distant, it was far away. They saw it as a possible counterweight to Moscow, but the church was under the domination of the Turks, deeply corrupt. They had to pay for every office, metropolitans, bishops, abbots, everyone had to pay for their office. Because after 1453, the Greek church went into a sharp decline. In 1589, Patriarch Jeremiah II of Constantinople granted full ecclesiastical independence to the Ukrainian Orthodox Brotherhoods. These essentially were urban Orthodox guilds. Then he cursed anyone who rejected this model of church government in Ukraine. Now, I call the units a chimera. There were a few loyal bishops who remained, Gideon Balaban, Michael Kopiastansky, and those coming from the consecrations of Theophan of Jerusalem. In 1597, though, the Ecumenical Patriarchate, the Patriarch of Miletius, condemned and anathematized the union. Now, 2 years later, the Polish crown guaranteed full religious freedom, but the nobles created their confederations and fought him. But in order to have a united front against the Turks, they had to give a little bit. The confederations were the problem, not the Polish monarch, who tended to be sympathetic towards them, but the work of St. Peter Mogila, the brotherhoods, the school at Ostrog. That Orthodox tradition was rebuilt on a different basis. And the Cossacks were the sole protector of the Orthodox Church, and really the only thing keeping the Church from being destroyed entirely. That meant that Cossack revolutionaries, national liberation, and the Orthodox Church became one and the same thing. This ended with the Treaty of Pereslav. Khmelnytsky saw Ukraine as a distinct nation, as opposed to the Uniat movement and Jews, Poles, excluded from it. The church is where nations get their main mark of identity. The Uniates were seen as not Ukrainian, but Polish partisans. And it's bizarre that the Uniat movement in Western Ukraine today is the core of the anti-Russian national movement, which is very strange because it was created to serve two foreign powers, the Vatican and Poland. I'm willing to say that Khmelnytsky is quite possibly the most important single man in Ukrainian history after St. Vladimir. His defeat to the Poles destroyed usury and parasitism for a long time. It showed the Poles and the Jews what they were capable of. It created an independent Cossack state that stood briefly as a new form of state organization. Now, when Khmelnytsky died, it fell apart and led to what we call the ruin, the slow dissolution of this state as the Poles reasserted themselves. I should note that Khmelnytsky was granted a patent by the Ecumenical Patriarch. The Patriarch sent him a sword as a sign that Khmelnytsky was going to take up the defense of the Orthodox faith. Khmelnytsky captured almost all of Little Russia, but he couldn't resist Poland for a long time, and that's why he ended up going to Moscow under the Treaty of Pereslav and to accept the Cossack host under Moscow. Moscow diplomats hesitated. They didn't want a new war with Poland. But even when the treaty was concluded in 1654, all Khmelnytsky had was the left bank of the Dnieper, possibly on the, right up to Kiev. Under Moscow, this part of Ukraine, which was inaccessible to the Poles, became populated and flourished because a lot of runaways ended up there. The right bank was in worse shape. It was a battlefield between Cossacks, Poles, Tartars, and was increasingly deserted. Let me go back a little bit. The collective term for the Polish landlords was the Słowacy. They were the ones who brought in the Jews centuries before for the sake of ensuring that a merchant class would never develop in the cities. The Jews organized themselves into the Kahal system and was granted a free rein as to whatever they wanted to do, especially if it oppressed the Orthodox. It was a plan that kept the confederations and the landlords from ever being co-opted by the money from the cities. This was the reason for the killings, for the rebellion. I'm not sure what else you expect anyone to do. Orthodox people sometimes today wince at this, as if this isn't commanded in the Old Testament. The high rates of interest from the Jews, the lack of any common morality, ensured that Jews were hated by everyone, except Polish landlords. There was no incentive anywhere to establish good relations with the Orthodox, since the Catholic elite ensured their safety. Using Jews as financiers and leaseholders meant that peasants could be destroyed without any consequences. Heinrich Graetz, who I quoted in my own book, who was a German Jew, who rejected the Zohar, and to some extent the Talmud, talked about the high nobility in Poland being dependent on Jews. So it was to balance Polish flightiness, levity, unsteadiness, extravagance, and recklessness. On the other side was Jewish prudence and economy and caution. Graetz goes so far as to say the Jew was more than a financier to the Polish nobleman. He was his help in embarrassment, his prudent advisor, his all in all. So, but rather than learning, they learned nothing from any of this. Both the Kahal and the Słowacy, they increased their repression. Initially, the statutes of Kalisz was the issued law to bring Jews into the cities. Poland was the paradise of the Jews. Jews who wanted to escape persecution from Germany headed east towards Poland. And that's really where Yiddish came from and how it emigrated to the Polish Empire. Of course, they would never assimilate. They didn't know the language of the Christian Poles or Ukrainians. But they were involved in commerce, usury, and illicit sexual activity. The Jews had no personal contact with the Poles, despite having lived in their country for centuries. It was a state within a state. But even the slaughter of Khmelnytsky didn't dissuade them, because you had more rebellions later, Barabas, Rosin, Pilei, the same set of complaints. Now, occasionally, the monarch as strong as Jan III Sobieski might be able to hire foreigners, mercenaries to fight for him, because Poland never had a centralized army. But in that case, military victories were a sure route to increasing power. And I said before, the Szem, the Słowacy, was quite willing to sacrifice their security. And they would deliberately lose a war against Turkey, for example, to keep the monarch from gaining any real power. Even the defeat of their enemies was a problem, because if the crown was responsible for it, that would increase the prestige, income, and power of the monarch. So some of these rebellions were deliberately provoked to avoid having the crown having a skilled standing army at his disposal, even if it would secure the country increased trade. Now, this is going to have to be a two-parter because I'm nowhere near finished here. And I know a lot of my readers are very interested in this. But let me end this way, just for now. In 1686, maybe 40 years after the Khmelnytsky uprising and the formation of the Hetman state, the Hetman elected on the left bank was Semilovich. The Russians always pushed too far, ignoring their treaty obligations. Semilovich was very pro-Russia, and he ended up having to send conditions to Moscow for his continued participation within the Pereyaslav Union. He talked about the Kievan Metropolitan remaining an exarch of Constantinople, which implied the full nationalization of the church and its independence. Moscow, on paper, accepted all of these conditions using the exarch of Constantinople title, but they nullified them all in 1686. That's when the Tsar bought the Kievan Metropolitanate from a prostrate ecumenical patriarch. By the middle of the 17th century, problems became worse. After the great victories of Khmelnytsky against Polish landlords, his former lieutenants, including Vyachovsky, Ivan Vyachovsky, and Pavel Teteria, split the Cossack host along class lines. On the one hand, Ivan Vyachovsky leaned towards Poland as a reaction to the Russian presence in Ukraine and their high taxes. By his death in 1664, Russians under the Pereyaslav Treaty created their own new noble Cossack class with serfs and everything else that separated the formerly populist Cossack idea of people like pro-Russian hetmans like Syedotchny and created a Russianized noble class. So people like Vyachovsky, who wanted that third option within the Polish Commonwealth, all the pro-Moscow faction would be used to attempt to destroy him. Moscow, at least according to Doroshenko, the other great Ukrainian historian, that Moscow was deliberately spreading myths to the effect that the Hetman was going to hand Ukraine over to the Poles. So those loyalties, as well as class, split the Cossack host right down the middle. And that became the norm. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. This is part one. Next week, we'll continue with this as part two on the Cossacks, the Jews, and the Polish Empire. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll talk more about this next week. Bye-bye.